Okay, I'm going to start. Today is the last class before we break for the summer. We'll finish up with Rav Avadya Yosef. Before we do, as has been the practice, I've communicated with some people during the week, so let me make a couple comments. I accept the criticism that the end of last class, when I mentioned, the middle of last class, that Rav Avadya is special because he and Rav Moshe focus on the non-religious communities that are not completely religious, and I mentioned that Rav Schechter is perhaps unique among the American poskim in still dealing with these type of communities, and someone mentioned correctly Chabad also. Obviously, Chabad is out there in the all the different states, and they're dealing with non-religious, but I will just say one point about that, that Chabad rabbis open up Chabad houses, and they do what they want. That's very different than someone who's hired for a shul, let's say, and the shul has doesn't have a machitza in it, or there's all sorts of things going on in the shul, and the rabbi, on the one hand, wants to keep his job. On the other hand, dealing with, so a little bit of a difference. Another point, I had mentioned that Rav Hinkin was a rabbi in Georgia. I actually checked it on Google Maps. The city he was in is actually a bit north of Georgia, so it's not exactly Georgia. And finally, we mentioned last class, we ended last class with what Rav Shach said about the Sfaradim, and someone made a negative comment wondering, is he a gadol? And I said that even if you think he's a bad gadol, by which I meant obviously nothing personal, just that his influence is having what you think to be a negative influence. And I think Rav Lichtenstein's written about this, that he thinks that some of the things he said was very negative. I still want to make a comment that I still think that we need to, in our community at least, to take the high ground on these issues, that obviously you have to analyze Rav Shach and you can look at what he says, and he said some terrible things about Rav Soloveitchik's ideas. He said terrible things, from our perspective at least, about the Hesder movement. But I do think that as a community that we should, as I said, take the high ground and give complete respect and kavod for the Torah knowledge they have, to people like Rav Shach, to the Satmar Rav, and obviously disagree with their position. The fact that their members of that community will refer to people in our community as JD and other things, I think it's important not to to go down to that level, and that's the only point I would make. I also checked the statistics. Shas today has 12 seats, and their height was 17 seats. That was in 97, I believe, not 92. Okay, let's pick up where we were last class. We ended last class by talking about the break between the Rav Shach and the Shas party, which was really seen when Rav Shach said that the Sfaradim are not capable of leading, and that really led to the great break. And really, it was inevitable. Sephardic society was ripe for an ethnic party that would encompass the whole community, which, while not orthodox per se, was traditional. You all know, I'm sure, about Sephardim. They have a strong traditional flavor to them, even if many of them are not totally observant. And after all, how long were the Sephardim supposed to take orders from Ashkenazi Torah authorities who conducted their deliberations in Yiddish, for that matter? And here we come to Rav Avadya's real significance. It is Rav Avadya who single-handedly restored the pride to Sephardic Jewry. The slogan of Shas is Hachazir Aparal Yoshna, to restore the crown to its old glory, and that really says it all. Rav Avadya ushered in an era, we're in this era today, in which Sephardim were not to be regarded, and not to regard themselves anymore, as second-class citizens. This was an enormous social achievement, and really explains why the Sephardic world united around Rav Avadya. People who are not even Shomer Shabbos, giving him 17 seats, now he has 12 seats. This is a Haredi party, and yet the voters are not Haredi at all. Now, as I said, Sephardi society has a range of religious observances, and the Shas party, through its schools and its kollels now, is influencing the young. But for the most part, the voters are not what we would consider orthodox, and they're certainly not Haredi. And that's very important. What makes his achievement even more significant is that until the Gaza withdrawal, Rav Avadya and Shas were identified with the Dovish political movements. Rav Avadia always wanted to go with labor. He enjoyed, as I said, a very good relationship with Shimon Peres. I think here you see a sign of Rav Avadia's great honesty in that we know that he's convinced, he's written about it, you can give back land. He remains convinced that if you can get a real peace, the state of Israel should give back land. And yet, he could have gotten more seats. Had he adopted a hawkish political position, the Sfaradim, who are very much on the right, he would have voted for him instead of 17 seats. Maybe he could have had 22 seats. Who knows? Maybe he could have overcome even become the second largest party. It's incredible that he is able to get all these votes from the Sfaradim, who as a whole are very much on the right. They vote for him despite his dovish outlook. And he had the strength of character not to change his position in order to increase his vote to count even more. So I think that's something impressive. We spoke last class about how Shas played up the comments of Rav Shach, the anti-Sephardic comments, and I'll say that it's not just Shas that uses plays up the ethnic divide and even engages in anti-Ashkenazic sentiment. Rav Avadia does it as well, and it's not only when he's speaking to the masses, which you can maybe justify based on for political purposes. If you look in the introduction to volumes 1 and 3 of his massive work Yabia Omer, he has a very strong criticism there of the way the Ashkenazim learn. Those of you who've been to an Ashkenazi yeshiva, you know it's all lumdus, it's all about the theoretical truth, and from the Ashkenazic perspective, that is the ultimate. In Rav Soloveitcher's Halachic Man, he explains how the true goal of Torah study is not the halacha l'maisa, it's not the practical halacha, but the theoretical truth. It's like the difference between a medical doctor, and a professor of medicine, or someone who devotes himself to theory. And Rav Soloveitcher develops the idea how in the Brisker school, in the Lithuanian approach, becoming a practicing rabbi, engaging in practical halacha, is a come down. You want to really be involved in the total theoretical pursuit of halacha. And Rav Avadia very much is opposed to that. Yes, Rabbi Hirsch points out that there are Ashkenazic rabbis. We spoke about three classes ago, how the Chazon Ish was very upset with the way Ashkenazic society had gone. And you have the Ritbaz. But if you look at the yeshiva world, and you've been to yeshivas, and I'm sure many people listening, and you take a shiur, is the shiur, as Rav Avadia says it should be, La'atsuke shemasta alivet hilchata, do you start with the Gemara and then work your way to the Beit Yosef and come to the Halacha? Absolutely not. When you learn Yoreh Deh, you do that. But when you learn Bab Metzia or Yevamos, I mean, you're doing it for the Svaras, for the intellectual attainment, for the Lumdus. And the Rosh Yeshiva are not post-scheme. It's almost unheard of today to have Rosh Yeshiva as a post-take. And that is what Rav Avadia attacks in his introductions. He sees this as a distortion of Torah. Another big thing is that the Ashkenazim don't believe in learning Yachronim, the recent authorities. And Rav Avadia says, well, then who's going to learn your works if you don't learn the Yachronim? It's a totally different approach. And Rav Avadia, in numerous places, makes negative comments on what he sees as Ashkenazic Bacharim sitting and wasting their time in a Zaman, let's say, in 5-6 months in yeshiva, they'll learn 20 daf, 30 daf, tops. And he thinks they should be learning 150 daf, and the Bekiyos is what it's all about. And this ties into the other elements, which we'll get to in a minute, that he doesn't believe that we should be engaged in Chiddush. Everything valuable, pretty much, has been said. Our job is to study it, not to try to create it. We see Rav Avadia's opposition to the Ashkenazic hegemony as well. When he became chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1969, one of the first things he did, and he did it very publicly, was declare that Sephardim could be married during the 3 weeks. Sephardic practice is only not to be married from Rosh Chodesh until Tisha B'Av. Rav Schechter does have the same approach, and I was shocked, actually. I didn't know this. This is already a few years ago. He came to West Orange, my town, and this was in memory of the Rav. So he spoke, supposedly speaking about the Rav, and he developed his ideas on Limud Torah, and I was sitting there shocked. This is totally opposite to everything the Rav stood for. He's talking about how there's no need. Someone asked about women learning Gemara, and he said, we don't need men to learn so much Gemara. What do we need to learn? Men don't need to learn Cholin and other things. You should learn Mishnah Berurah. I mean, the whole notion that Rav Soloveitcher developed about learning for its own sake, Lishma as being the highest level, he seems to have no regard for that. So I don't know. In many ways, he's not a Talmud of the Rav. Getting back to Rav Avadia, unless you have another question here. Gemara and Rashi is 90% of learning. Understood, but the Rav was all into Lungus. That's the look in Halacha Command. Maybe we'll get back to this at the end when we speak more about the difference between Rav Avadia and traditional yeshiva approach. Herschel Schachter, where he's talking, his emphasis is not on the lumdus. He throws it in sometimes, but I have never been in a shiur, but everyone knows that he's a posek, obviously, where the Rav was not the posek in that sense. So we'll get back to this in a little bit. Rav Avadia in his tshuva explaining this says that the Sephardic Rabbanim has felt second class compared to the Ashkenazim, and therefore, because the Ashkenazic practice is to not allow weddings, and when we think not allow weddings, it's not so simple. In America, obviously, you can do what you want, but in Israel, you can't just show up in Israel and perform a wedding. You have to be approved by the religious committees they have there, and they have rules, and the rule was you could not get married. No rabbi was permitted to perform a wedding during that period. Just like today, no rabbi is permitted unless they're given approval. You can't be a conservative rabbi, let's say. And Rav Avadia, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, changed it and said, we're going to perform the weddings because we're Sephardim. And on the contrary, it's the Ashkenazim who are supposed to be listening to us because this is the territory of Rav Yosef Karo. Along similar lines, we spoke about the various takanot that Rav Herzog made. And Rav Ozia went along with all these takanot. One of them is that you can no longer do yibum. You have a levirate marriage. Why? Well, Sephardim, though, their practice always was to do levirate marriage. Ashkenazim did chalitza. So Rav Avadia is very upset, and he said he retracted that. He said that we will no longer go along with the Ashkenazim in this. When he became chief rabbi, he voided Rav Uziel's takana. He said that Rav Uziel wanted to make peace with the Ashkenazim, but today we can stand up and be proud Sephardim. I don't know if he's correct that Rav Uziel wanted to make peace. I think Rav Uziel agreed that in today's day and age, it's not a proper thing to do. But Rav Avadia rejects that. In his responsa, you do always see respect for Ashkenazic authorities, but it's not the way Ashkenazim relate to their authorities. For example, he will dispute with the Vilna Gaon. That's something that no Ashkenazi today would ever dream of doing. They tremble at the mention of the Vilna Gaon. But in general, you find great respect for Ashkenazi authorities, but not always when he speaks from the cuff. For example, both the biographies I mentioned before discuss the storm that arose when he spoke about the Chazon Ish. And Rav Avadia said that the Chazon Ish liked to pile, this is a quote, pile chumras on top of chumras. And he said that the Chazon Ish is not to be regarded as a posek. What does that mean? Chazon Ish not a posek? And Rav Avadia says because a posek has to be one who's in a community, who's dealing with people, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, like others. The Chazon Ish was in a yeshiva world community. And Rav Avadia feels that that doesn't make you, you can't be a posek when you're dealing with yeshiva bachrim. You need to deal with the community at large. After he said that, one of the leading Ashkenazi Haredi spokesmen came out and said Rav Avadia is playing with fire. Because it is, to start downplaying the significance of the Chazon Ish, it's almost unheard of. But again, for the Sephardi, like Rav Avadia, the Chazon Ish is just another Ashkenazi posek. Now, for those who know Rav Avadia of today, who towers over the Sephardic world and towers over the Shas party, it's hard to imagine that it was only 20 years ago that he was a pawn of the Ashkenazim, that the party was created, it was controlled by Ashkenazim. And I will say that when you read the story, I hope they translate these books into English, of how he summoned the courage to break with the Ashkenazim, break with Rav Shach, it really is inspiring and speaks to his great courage. He believed that the people would follow him. In fact, the members of the Moetzes Chachmei HaTorah of Shas, who were all appointed by Rav Shach, and were from the Panavej Yeshiva, there's a whole group of Sephardim who were educated there, they broke with Rav Avadia. They said, we have to go with Rav Shach. But Rav Avadia knew the people would follow him. He went, the people followed him, and his party soon became the most important, what we call Haredi party, and he created his own Moetzet, his own Moetzet Chachmei Torah. So it also, I believe, for those who are not of the Haredi mindset, I think you have to get a lot of satisfaction seeing the very group, the Sephardim, the Shas party, Rav Avadia, who were told that you are not capable of leading, that you are not qualified to lead, to see them breaking the stranglehold by the Haredim and actually becoming more powerful than them, taking over the various ministries. Of course, as I said, with the inevitable financial corruption that came along with it. But to see them coming out on top is, I think, inspiring and speaks to Ravavadi, as I said, his great confidence that the people would follow him. Now, in terms of his long-term significance, I see no question, in my mind, there's no question that Rav Avadia is the most important Sephardic figure since Rav Yosef Karo, and as I wrote in my article, you can say from Yosef, that is Yosef Karo, to Yosef Avadi Yosef, none has arisen like Yosef. Unlike other Gedolim, who towered over Orthodoxy, people like Rav Moshe and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, during their time, but after their time, their influence began to decline, and we spoke already about that. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's influence, what influence is there now? So there's Shmir Shabbos Kelchasa. The Sfarim are coming out now against Shmir Shabbos Kelchasa, and Rav Yashiv's given Pesachim against Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and they follow Rav Yashiv. But Rav Avadia is not simply a giant for this generation. He accomplished the very rare feat of altering the course of Torah history in both a sociological and a religious sense. Now, you mentioned the Ben Ish Chai, whom I'll speak about in just 1 minute. The Ben Ish Chai was totally overthrown, so that today he has no significance. And I'll speak about that right now. And there was Rav Avadia, who totally overthrew the Ben Ish Chai. And as for the Chidah, after the Shulchan Aruch, the only figure called Maran by the Sfardim was the Chidah, Maran HaChidah. And now you have Maran Rav Avadia Yosef. But the Chidah can't compare to Rav Avadia, for reasons I'll speak about, because the Chidah's influence has stopped. It was, in his time, it was very influential. But Rav Avadia has influence, as I'll try to prove in a few minutes, that's going to go on after his lifetime very significantly. And if you weigh the Chidah and Rav Avadia, like if you take the Vilna Gaon or Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Vilna Gaon wins. If you take the Chidah, who lived the same time as the Vilna Gaon, or Rav Avadia wins, hands down. Now, Rav Avadia's tendency is certainly to be lenient. And in this, we'll see how he permanently alters the halachic tradition of Sephardic Jewry. It goes further than that. When he was campaigning, because it was a campaign to be chief rabbi in 1972, he stated that unlike the Ashkenazim, who like to be machmir, who go like Beis Shammai, the Sfardim go like Beis Hillel. Now, if that isn't ethnic baiting, I don't know what is. His point was that the Sfardim are more in touch with the people, with Klal Yisrael, and they show this by going lakula. That his idea was that Ashkenazim try to be frum. And frum is not a good word. Frum is a bad word, by picking up on chumras. But the Sfardim try to adopt the lenient position, because if you have an option to be makil, to be lenient, that's where you go. That's been not, obviously you don't intend every time to do that, but if you have an option to be lenient, because you're not dealing with a yeshiva world here who wants chumras, you're dealing with the average person. And the job of a posek is to try, if he can, to try to find a kula, if it's a valid kula. That's always been Rav Avadia's position. Now, Rav Avadia has had chumras, what we would call chumras. He doesn't call them chumras. He thinks they're me'ikar adin. You ask, is Rav Avadia against secular studies? When you say against secular studies, he's not against it in a halachic sense. He's against secular studies because he feels you should learn Torah, but he does have a tshuva that says that you can get, if you get a doctorate in Jewish studies, it's regarded as limud Torah. He's against secular studies, not for ideological reasons. He's against secular studies because you want to study Torah. But he has many people, many followers who have secular studies. He doesn't have an ideological thing against it. His daughter opened up a school, I think, for girls now with secular studies. So he doesn't have this Ashkenazic opposition to secular studies. He's spoken at Bar-Ilan. I mean, it's a very different approach. And I wouldn't say he's against secular studies. He's against secular studies. He can make a living without it. But he doesn't have an ideological opposition to it. For example, shadels. Rav Avadia is opposed to shadels. He's been opposed to them for 40 years, written many tshuva. He believes it's forbidden and a woman has to wear a tichel. She's not allowed to wear a shadel. But I can't really think of any other halachic positions where Rav Avadia would be regarded as machmir. And this is, he didn't make this up, this opposition to shadels. Shadels really are a European phenomenon that come from really the Renaissance in Italy. In general, you can say that he is a makil, and there's no question that today the final address for the most complicated questions of personal status is Rav Avadia. And in many other areas, gelatin, for example. I shouldn't say gelatin is more an Israel-American thing. In Israel, they've been eating gelatin for a long time. This goes back to the Pesach of Rosh Pesach Frank in the 50s and others. But Rav Avadia, I mean, his position is able to leave the land of Israel. And for him, all gelatin is permissible, even pigskin. Some poskim hold that only the beef gelatin. Rav Avadia is not strict about chalak meat. That's not true. Sfaradim as a whole follow the Beit Yosef, which means they should have chalak. However, Rav Avadia holds that if you're a Sfaradi and you're not Ashkenazi's house, you can eat the meat. He says it's a sfek sfeika. Maybe the halacha is like the Ramah, which is incredible when you think of it, because usually we go to Shulchan Aruch, and maybe there wasn't any adhesion. So Rav Avadia, unlike many other Sephardic poskim, says that you can eat, and if you're invited to an Ashkenazi house, the Sephardi can eat the meat there, even though it's not halak. The Syrian community, for example, never had halak meat earlier, and they relied on not just his heter. This is not only his heter. There's a heter of Shmuel Aboab about this. But Rav Avadia has, in fact, Rav Avadia goes further. Most Sephardim do not believe that you can eat, let's say, food that, if the Jew lit the pilot light, that it's considered bishul akum, food cooked by a Gentile, unless the Jew cooks the whole thing. Which means that a Sephardi would not be able to eat any restaurants in the United States, because all the restaurants rely on the notion that the Jew lights the flame. Not the pilot light, the flame itself. Rav Avadia says that Sephardim could eat at all these restaurants. Again, he applies the sfek sfeika, a double doubt. So he is not machmir in that sense. In fact, he's a big makil. He's more makil than any other Sephardi posek. Because other than Rav Avadia, the standard view is that Sephardim do always have to eat chalak meat, as far as I know. Chalak is a got. According to the Ashkenazim, the Ashkenazim stock, we don't have to eat got. The fact that they serve glot now, first of all, it's a chumra. Second of all, it's not real glot. The glot you get in the supermarket today is not glot. You can get something called Beit Yosef, but it's not. All glot today means is that it has a higher level of supervision and that certain very small, they're not really adhesions, but the Sephardim wouldn't permit them. They would regard them as adhesions. Ashkenazim would permit them, and they regard that as a sort of glot, but it's not technically glot. Real glot means that the lung is completely smooth. That's what Sephardim are only permitted to eat, unless, as Rav Avadia says, you're invited to someone's house, etc. Yeah, if there's no holes in the lung, but what they say glot today, Sephardim don't regard it as glot. It's between real glot, which is Sephardic, and regular meat. I guess it's a higher level than regular meat because you don't have to ask the real Shaila. What it means when you say it's not glot is that you have to actually ask. The bodek has to come look at it and see, is this kosher or not? And if he says it's kosher, it's 100% kosher. Little adhesions, which you don't really need to ask a shayla for, Sephardim won't accept, Ashkenazi will. So technically it's not glot, but in American parlance it's glot. And many products, by the way, would say glot in them. Have nothing even to do with that. It just means it's a high level of supervision. For example, next time you're in a supermarket, take a look at Empire Chickens. They'll say glot on them, or even fish. I've seen glot fish. Now, if anything is able to change the common practice in America about gelatin, it certainly will be Rav Avadia's tshuva. Or how about his tshuva about dishwashers? It's hard to understand why you need two dishwashers. Rav Moshe Feinstein said you should have two dishwashers, and that became the practice. But what do you need two dishwashers for? You're putting soap in. It's what we call pogum. Plenty of poskim said you don't. I'm sure in Israel the practice is not so. And Rav Avadia has a very long tshuva, and it's those sort of tshuvas that maybe in America will be harder to break in because we have a minhag. But in Israel, his influence is not just on the Sephardim. It's on an entire world of Ashkenazim as well who are not Haredim. If Rav Avadia says it, they will follow him as well. And Rav Avadia has never regarded himself as only speaking to Sephardim. He used to have a weekly program on the radio, Pinat Halacha, and many people, many non-Sephardim, have followed his psukim. Another great leniency, which would be unthinkable in this country, is his ruling that if you have a restaurant that serves milk and meat, but serves them cold, for example, one after another, it serves them one after another. First you have meat, and then if you want to have ice cream dessert, they'll serve it to you. Or even we'll serve them together. At the same time, if they're both cold, and the restaurant wants a hashgacha, not on the restaurant, but on the meat. That is, that the meat sold here is kosher. Rav Avadya says you're obligated to give a hashgacha to this restaurant. He calls it a chova kadosha. That's a holy obligation. So that, why? You're saving the people. These people, these semi-religious or non-religious people, who otherwise would be eating treif. If you'd say to them, we're not going to give you hashgacha on the meat in your restaurant, therefore the person, what is the proprietor? He's not going to have hashgacha. He doesn't care. He's going to get treif meat. At least this way, the meat he's going to get, because he wants to have a hashgacha, he wants to have kosher, because some people only eat kosher. But if you're going to tell him we're not going to give hashgacha to the restaurant, he can't put any tuda up on it, what does he care? I'll get the treif meat. Rav Avadya says, you have to give a hashgacha to this restaurant. Now, in America, it would be unheard of for any of the hashgacha companies to give a hashgacha. Even if they're saying they're not giving it on the restaurant per se, they're just telling you that the meat, if you want to come in and get a salami, the meat they're serving you is kosher. It would never happen. Now, I know in my area, for example, they wouldn't even give hashgacha on a vegetarian restaurant if it's because it's open on Shabbos, even though it's owned by non-Jews. And yet Rav Avadya says, our job is to give as many hashgachas as we can. And then it's up to the people to determine. It's not leaf naiver. You're not misleading anyone. We all know about certain places that have hashgachas that we won't eat there because it's not up to our standards. It would be the same thing about this restaurant that serves meat and then serves ice cream for dessert. The frum people wouldn't go there. But the rest of the population, at least they would be sure to get kosher meat. And the frum person, I guess, if you were hungry and you needed something, you're in the middle of nowhere, and this is there, and the hashgacha tells you that the meat is kosher, I guess what's the problem? You can get the meat there, too. The Tzitz Eliezer was very upset about this tshuva, and he attacks Rav Avadya for it. But Rav Avadya defends himself and reaffirms it, that our job is to give as many hashgachas as we can. Therefore, we save people from eating treif. And if you think of it, I don't know, maybe some of you could come up with some objection, but I'm not sure exactly why that would be a bad thing to do in America. Just because the restaurant's open on Shabbos, let's say, and just because they serve milk, and, you know, it's no different than giving maybe on a packaged item. I don't know. Maybe the politics are different, but from Ravadia's perspective, our job is to try to give people kosher food. We can't guarantee that then they're not going to eat dairy with it, but that's not our concern. At least we're saving them from eating treif. This is a Klal Yisrael outlook, a communitarian type of view in which you want to be mezak et harabin. You want to bring all of the Jews to observance of mitzvot, as opposed to, I guess, our approach in which we're trying to create, you know, closed communities. What's the market for such a place in America? I don't know what the market. You're right. In America, perhaps you don't have it, but I can give you one example. You have these delis that, because the good hashgachas won't give hashgacha to it, they get, you know, the hashgachas that aren't so good. And in theory, you could say, why, maybe a good hashgacha, if a good hashgacha would give it just on the meat, then at least, you know, the meat would be kosher. So the conservative or the reform Jews who are going there, at least when they went there, they'd be getting kosher meat. Now the meat they're getting is a very questionable kosher. So I don't know. You're right. There might not be the same market as there is. All right, but take the Upper West Side. There's plenty of Jews on the Upper West Side. You know, there's non-kosher delis there. If you said to them, I'll give you a little hashgacha, and you can still serve, you know, your meat and then your cheese, just don't make it together. I don't know if there's a market in America, but certainly there's a market in Israel, and that was what Rav Avadya was responding to. Okay, let's move on. Well, let me give you one other example. Hot water. I don't know what the general psak is. I believe the general psak of at least in America is that Rabbanim say you can't use hot water on Shabbos. Rav Avadya is not so, because then the only way you'd be allowed to use it is if you lowered the furnace, which I do every Friday in my house, below Yad Salat Espo, which I guess 120 degrees or something like that. But Rav Avadya says that it's better, ra'oi l'hachmir, not to use hot water. Clear implication is that, and he has a tshuva explaining why there shouldn't be any problem using it, and then at the end he says, it's better not to. What this means, if you know how to read his tshuva, says it's better not to, but if it's hard for you, if you have children or old people, you know, he explains psikreshet ol michale and all sorts of other halachic ideas. Rav Avadya is the famous psak about Israel using the Dud HaShemesh, the heater, which is not just Rav Avadya. Rosh Hashanah Zalman Rabach also held, in the first edition of Shmir Shabbos Golcha so that you can use the solar heaters on Shabbos. However, the outcry was so much in the Haredi world that the second edition of Shmir Shabbos, it's out. You can no longer use it. But Rav Avadia doesn't have to be concerned with these threats. And plenty of Israelis, I believe probably the majority of Israel uses, I'm talking about the very from Israel, who still uses the solar heater on Shabbos. What I think you can say is that operating in an environment removed from conservative Jewry, there's no denomination called Orthodoxy, there's never been machlokas, there's never been fights over what defines halachic Judaism, Rav Avadia is organically able to come to certain conclusions that cause so much controversy in the States. Take his tshuva on the bat mitzvah. The bat mitzvah was the subject of so much controversy because you're imitating the conservatives, and the conservatives got it from the reformers, who instituted confirmation, and then this became bat mitzvah. Mordechai Kaplan was the first bat mitzvah. You have all these meta-halachic factors. Rav Avadia simply examines the issue. Is there a problem with the bat mitzvah? What could possibly be the problem of celebrating a girl's attainment of mitzvah? Well, in America, there could be lots of problems. As I said, you have Mordechai Kaplan, you have the reformers, but for Rav Avadia, this is not a concern, and therefore, not surprisingly, he concludes that having a bat mitzvah for a girl is a very good thing. He can look at the pure halachic sources without being concerned about the impact. Now, Rav Avadia's vision, and this comes through in all his Sfarim, is a Torah society in which the Sephardic authorities lead, both because they're better poskim, and also because the land of Israel is supposed to be Sephardic land, Atrei de Maran, the territory of the Shulchan Aruch. In some of his writings, you actually get the impression that according to Rav Avadia, everyone, even Ashkenazim, are obligated to conduct themselves in accord with the Shulchan Aruch, because he says that the Shulchan Aruch is the authority in the land of Israel, and anyone who comes to the land of Israel has to conduct themselves. But in other places, he backs off from that. For example, he speaks about Ashkenazim in Israel observing Kitnios. Now, if he held that Ashkenazim shouldn't be observing Kitnios, it makes no sense for him to have a tshuva like that. However, I do believe that if, as an individual, you'd go up to Rav Avadia and ask him, do I, as an Ashkenazi in the land of Israel, need to observe Kitnios? I am pretty certain, and this should be checked out, that he would tell you you don't have to. But in speaking about communities, he's not getting up there and saying that all Ashkenazim have to change their practices. But if an individual wants to become a Sfardi, there are many places in his writings where he appears to think that's just great. In fact, he thinks that that's the better thing to do. And when he attacks the Ashkenazim for a number of their practices, he points out that this is the land of Maran, and this is how we do things. Now, let's explain why, though, I say that he's the most important posek. First of all, this position about the Shulchan Aruch, that all Sfardi must follow the Shulchan Aruch, as far as I know, he's the first posek to say this. And it was very controversial. In his youth, the major posek of the Iraqi community, and he's from the Iraqi community, was the Ben Ish Chai. They studied his work every Shabbos. He was the posek Acharon. Just like you could say Ashkenazim today, it's the Mishneh Berurah, it was the Ben Ish Chai. The problem with the Ben Ish Chai is, at least for Rav Avadia, is that the Ben Ish Chai disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch in a number of places. And the Iraqis would follow the Ben Ish Chai. Already in his teenage years, Rav Avadia began to give speeches and shiurim, and he began preaching against the Ben Ish Chai. This created an enormous controversy, because going against the Ben Ish Chai in his community, the Ben Ish Chai was regarded as the leading saint and authority. It created, as I said, a great controversy. He was banned from certain shuls. His book, his first book, Chazon Avadia, was even burnt. There was talk of putting him in Cheirim, but Rav Avadia continued, and we can say today, we could have said it by 20 years ago, he achieved complete victory. The Iraqi community abandoned the Ben Ish Chai and went with Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia's psukim, namely, that when it comes to the Shulchan Aruch versus the Ben Ish Chai, you go like the Shulchan Aruch. Yes, the Ben Ish Chai is more Kabbalistic. That's why he disagreed a lot with the Shulchan Aruch. As I said, this is not a traditional position. All the other poskim believe that you can follow your previous minhag, but Rav Avadia says no. He developed the idea that in the land of Israel, even though the Shulchan Aruch never demanded it, the Shulchan Aruch has been accepted as the posek of the land of Israel. We must accept it. Let me show you how this played out in the real world. Women, according to the Shulchan Aruch, are not supposed to make a mitzvah on positive time-bound commandments. like Alula, for example. And yet many Sephardic communities, that was the practice. In the Syrian community, many did it. In the Iraqi community, they did it. In many communities, they did it. And then, so there was a machloket. When Rav Avadia began to assume importance, he insisted, and he published about it and spoke about it, that women must not make the bracha on a lulav or on any other positive commandment, because it's against what the Shulchan Aruch said. And other poskim disagreed with him. They said, we have our practice, this predates the Shulchan Aruch, etc. What happened? If you look around today, Rav Avadia has succeeded in almost entirely uprooting the Sephardic world's practices. When I gave this talk, which I'm giving right now, in the Syrian community, Rabbi Shammai afterwards spoke about how in his own community this changed in the last 30 years, how growing up women made brachas on the lulav, but the influence of Rav Avadia slowly turned that into a bracha levatala, something forbidden. And when I say he's significant and he's permanently altered the texture of Sephardic Jewry, this is not going to change when Rav Avadia is no longer here. This has now become the new practice, because you now have Rav Avadia's Sidurim, all the Sidurim published by him, the Yalkut Yosef, which is the new code published by his sons, the hundreds and hundreds of Dayanim and Rabbanim coming out of the schools, all advocating this position now. So you see a practice of women making a bracha on the lulav, which was a practice for 1,000 years, going back to medieval times in the Sephardic world, has been uprooted in the space of 30 years. What type of personality has the strength to uproot a practice of such long standing, no one but Rav Avadia? Let me give you another example. Yes, you mentioned, I was going to speak about this in a minute. You mentioned Rav Eliyahu. Yes, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and he put out his own Sidur called Kol Eliyahu, and he still upholds, I guess, the old time Iraqi position, but he can't stand up against Rav Avadia. He doesn't have the charisma or the following. Yes, there are some people who stand up in the Iraqi community and others. And you have Rav Mesas in the Moroccan community who stood up against Rav Avadia. But if you look at the length and breadth of the community, Rav Avadia has the people. And how many people does Rav Mordechai Eliyahu have in the Sephardic world? Very few. How many people does Rav Ben Sion Zalbashal have? Very few. It's Rav Avadia who can fill the stadiums. It's Rav Avadia who has everyone. Let me give you another example. There's a whole team of Rav Avadia's followers, all the Sidurim now, basically all of them. I just looked the other day in the West Orange in the Sephardic Minyan. They're all Rav Avadia Yosef Sidurim, the Chazon Avadia. Look in your local Sephardic Minyan. It's almost impossible to find Sidurim that are not the Sephardic Sidurim. And they have all the Sephardic Rav Avadia's practices, the Yalkut Yosef, which has become the new code of Jewish law. These have succeeded in slowly uprooting practices. Now, this is my thesis. I gave this talk in Rabbi Gisser, who's the Rav of Ofra, who was there in New York. He said, oh, it's excellent. What you said is 100% correct about what's going on now. But he says, I tell you that after 120, Rav Avadia is no longer here, the Moroccans are going to rise up, because they are the majority of the Sephardim, and they are feeling very upset, many of the Moroccan post-scheme, that their practices have been pushed asunder. And if what he's saying is correct, then what I'm saying is wrong, although I think it would be fascinating if practices that haven't been practiced in 30 years all of a sudden then come back. That would be quite interesting. And since there are no longer codes of Jewish law putting forth the Moroccan practice, I don't know. But we'll see. At least this is my approach. Let me give you another example. According to the Shulchan Aruch, women are supposed to make the bracha and then light the Shabbos candles. According to the Ashkenazic practice, women light the Shabbos candles and then make the bracha. There were many Sephardic women, and this is a practice of hundreds of years, who followed the Ashkenazic approach. Not because the Ashkenazim did it, because this predates the Shulchan Aruch. The Chida defended this. The Ben Ish Chai defended this. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu defended this. Rav Avadia began preaching 30 years ago, all women have to change. It's a bracha of Atala if they don't. It's a needless bracha, which is a big deal. And today, he has almost unanimously, there's basically unanimous agreement in the Sephardic world. He has been able to triumph over almost the entire Sephardic world. All these girls being educated in the Sephardic school, in the Shas schools and everything. Again, Rabbi Shammai described how in his own community, women used to do it the Ashkenazic way, but all his teachers were coming from Israel, Rav Avadia's students, and they succeeded in uprooting it. He also mentioned that for the first time a few years ago, they began having weddings in the 3 weeks before Rosh Chodesh, because Rav Aluf, who's the leading Sephardic Syrian rabbi with Rabbi Kassin, he's a Talmud of Rav Avadia. And so you see, what is this? A woman lighting the Shabbos candles. This is something she grows up watching her mother do it. I mean, you can't think of something that's more emotionally important for a woman. And here you have women who are lighting the Shabbos candles, and they saw their mothers and grandmothers lighting it by lighting the candles and then making the bracha. And here Rav Avadia comes and causes them to change his practice. Any other rabbi, they'd laugh at him, say, who are you? Tell me I'm going to change the practice, which we've been doing for hundreds of years, which my mother taught me. And yet Rav Avadia, no one else could do this. He was successful in pressuring and in convincing entire Sephardic communities to change practice of hundreds of years, which is so bound up with emotion and holiness. That shows his great significance. I can't imagine, despite what Rav Gisser says, I can't imagine this ever going back. Now that you have all the Dayanim are pretty much in the Sephardic order of Avadia trained, and you have the schools and the kolels, and you have his Sidurim and his Shulchan Aruch, it's very hard for me to imagine this could ever go back. And that's what I meant when I said that he is created a permanent alteration, a permanent change in the direction of Torah history, much like the Shulchan Aruch did, something you see only a few times in the millennium, because I believe these changes, I don't believe after Avadia is no longer here, that all of a sudden the women will then go back to the way their great-grandmothers were doing it or their grandmothers. I think this has become a permanent change in how women will light Shabbos candles. And there are many, many other examples. You have many Sephardic women now who won't make brachos ha-shachar. They won't make a bracha. For example, Shasani Kirtzono. They'll just make with Shema Malchus, with Hashem's name. This is because Rav Avadia. And he has Sidurim, in which they just say, Baruch Atah Shasani Kirtzono. And these are very widespread. I didn't realize how widespread until after I gave this talk in the Syrian community. And you had Egyptians there, and you had Iraqis, and you had Syrians telling me about how things they grew up with doing, women this is, now are no longer acceptable. And it's all because of Rav Avadia's influence of his Sidurim and his Talmidim. So in that sense, he's much more important than the Ben Ish Chai, simply because he was able to triumph over the Ben Ish Chai. And as I said, by now his victory is nearly complete. What I would say is that, though, by declaring a practice such as the Shabbos candles forbidden, which has such deep roots in Sephardic history, it is Rav Avadia who actually is radical and revolutionary. A fact which people don't often realize. It's Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, by insisting that women continue lighting Shabbos candles the way they always did, he is the traditionalist. He is following his practice. It's Rav Avadia, by uprooting such long-standing practices, that has shown that he is really the radical and the revolutionary. And normally, you know what happens to radicals and revolutionaries. They're put in cheder and their books are burnt, like happened in the 1950s. They burnt his book and they almost put him in cheder. The fact that Rav Avadia was able to triumph despite these views shows just how significant he is, and the significance is not only in the halachic area. What came first was the social factor. The fact he gave back the pride. He becomes chief rabbi and stands up to the Ashkenazim and shows that Sephardim can learn and Paskin. First, he gives back the pride to the Sephardic world, show them that they're not second-class citizens. And because they love him so much that they're willing to vote for him, even though they don't believe in anything he stands for politically, but they love him because they love his Torah and they love his who he is, this holy man, he was able to convince the Sephardic world to alter traditional practices, and certainly we have nothing like that in the Ashkenazic world. Yes, mimetic literary dichotomy. Finally, let me say a word about Rav Avadia's most incredible feature, and that's his incredible bekiut, the encyclopedic knowledge, the like which I've never seen in Jewish history. We had great bekiyim, Chaim Palachi, Rav Yosef Zachariah Stern, and others, but they're writing 100, 150 years ago, and the amount of responsa literature in the last 100 years equals that which is published in all the years before. And Rav Avadia has mastered all of it. If those who know Hebrew, because when I'm saying his incredible memory, it's hard to really put this in words. Just take up one of his books and see the 1,000 sources he quotes in every tshuva and everything under the sun. He doesn't need the CD-ROMs. He masters it all. So I was asked, have I ever seen in academia anyone like this with such a mind, such a memory? And I think, and the answer I'm going to give you, I think, helps explain why the Lithuanian yeshiva world has not been really taken in by Rav Avadya's greatness. They don't follow him, even though he knows more in one pinky, in terms of amount, than all the Rosh Yeshiva. And yet, they don't follow him. When I say the amount of knowledge he knows, say it again, it's incomprehensible. After I wrote that, someone said, well, what about Gershom Scholem? What about this? It's really apples and oranges. You're dealing with something the like of which I've never seen. And yet, why doesn't the Lithuanian world think so highly of him? How would he fare in the academic world? And the answer I gave is as follows. You take someone like Rav Soloveitchik, or Aaron Cutler, or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, or Moshe Feinstein, you take these geniuses in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, and if you took them out of the yeshiva world, and you put them in, let's say, the academic world, they can become great scientists, great philosophers, great others. You know, they clearly had great minds, and they showed that on every page of their writings with novel ideas, new approaches, new paradigms, chidushim. And yet, you don't see that in Rav Avadya. And what I'm going to tell you now, I went into, there was a number of Ashkenazim at this talk in Flatbush, and they came up to me afterwards and said they gave me a lot of credit because I was brave to go into the lion's den to say this because they wouldn't say it. But I don't think it's a criticism of Rav Avadya as much as explaining what type of knowledge he has versus the Ashkenazim. By the standards of the Ashkenazic world and of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, Rav Avadya's type of knowledge doesn't really count for that much, because in the academic world, you're judged, let's say, by the quality of your publications. And in the yeshiva world, you're judged by the profundity of your shiurim. The fact that you an issue is raised, and you could quote 300 sources on this issue, and then work off these sources and determine which you think is the better one and come to halacha, that's not how they work in the yeshiva world. In the yeshiva world, the idea is to come up with new insights, chidushim, novel ideas, chart new approaches. Rav Avadya does none of that. First of all, he was never trained in it. That's not his approach. For him, it's all about quantity of knowledge. The Talmud has a discussion about who's greater, the Sinai or the Ocher Harim, the one who has vast knowledge or the one who has insight. And certainly in the academic world and in the yeshiva world, amounts of knowledge don't really count for that much. It's nice to know. Everyone knows about people who have a lot of knowledge. But that doesn't get you a Nobel Prize. That doesn't get you to teach shiur in a top yeshiva. You have to have something new to say, some new insight. And that Rav Avadya doesn't have. And that's really the challenge to the yeshiva world and the academic world. That they really have no place for his type of knowledge. He has a different type of knowledge, a type of knowledge that for good or bad is not valued in the yeshiva world or in the academic world. That is vast amounts of information. I would say even this, what we think of as genius, in the Western world, creating new paradigms, his type of knowledge would stand in the way. Because if you're going to chart new paradigms, your mind can't be clogged with all these thousands of sources. You need to be able to look at matters anew, afresh. And that's what a genius is. And Rav Avadya, it's a different type of knowledge. Del points out something interesting, that the upshot of the Gemara is that the, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the Sinai which is greater. But they have all sorts of, if you want to know how they explain it, they say that that only applied when they didn't have books. Today we have all the books, so what do we need someone like Rav Avadya for? We go to the CD-ROM, we can go for the books. Today we don't need to go to someone. In those days you needed someone who could memorize and knew by heart all the different brightot. So therefore, he was more valuable than the real intellect, because you would need him. But today we don't need such a person, because it's all written down. Because Rav Avadya has a form of knowledge where it's really you gather lots of sources and then you work. He's a technician. You work one against the other, come up with differences, but you're not coming up with new ideas. In fact, he has a paper from the Rambam that just came out, and I got it because I thought maybe in the Rambam you have Chidushim. Even the Rambam, it's all the same thing. It's all the Bakiyas. It's all the sources. That's looked down in the yeshiva world, and that would be looked down obviously in the academic world. You can't publish an article just quoting a lot of sources, and you can't give a class just quoting various sources. You need to have new ideas, new approaches. But in Psak, there's a whole tradition of where the idea isn't to come up with new ideas, it's to work on the previous ideas and reach conclusions. That's not the Lithuanian approach, and clearly you can't do chidushim that way. But Rav Avadya is not about doing chidushim, novel ideas. From his perspective, all the important ideas have already been said. Our job is to study them, and then, of course, lead it into practical halacha. another problem that the Ashkenazim have, the Lithuanian world have with him, is that he counts. I mean, the Mishnah Berurah does this also, but Ravadi does more. He gathers sources, and he weighs them. Not completely. He doesn't say, like, five versus four, but he'll, if two people say one thing and ten say another, he doesn't feel the need to explain to you why the two are wrong and the ten are right. He'll simply say, Eino Mukhrach. It appears in his writing all the time, or Eino Mechuvar, that this view is not clear, or it's not appropriate, because look at all these other sources that disagree. And then he'll quote 10 or 15 other Acharonim who say differently, and they'll say, therefore, since the majority of poskim say this way, we go like that. However, from the Ashkenazic Lithuanian perspective, that's not how you do Pesach. The fact that one person says something and 10 disagree doesn't mean that the one person is wrong. You have to show qualitatively why my interpretation is incorrect. Simply telling me that what I'm saying is not clear because, and then quoting 10 other Acharonim who say differently and say that we go like those 10 Acharonim, and who am I to come up with a new idea, or my new idea is not set on halacha. From the Lithuanian perspective, that's what Torah is all about. And unless you can show me why my understanding of the Rambam or the Gemara is mistaken, the fact that 10 others disagreed with me, that's neither here nor there. It doesn't really matter. But that's not Rav Avadia's approach. Rav Avadia's approach is that, obviously, he makes distinctions between important achronim and less important, but it's very much about building a psechot, about adding authorities, and then seeing in which direction the general tradition goes. And then you see how easy it is to come to a lot of leniencies, because just he does hundreds of what we call sfeikas. There's doubts about so many things. And if you know all these achronim, you have loads of doubts. He often concludes it's a sfek sfeika, it's a doubt, there's doubt. Therefore, since it's Zerubbanan, we can go lakula, go leniently. It's a whole different approach. Go to the Bar Ilan computer, plug in sfek sfeika into Yigur and Moshe, and plug in sfek sfeika to Yabia Omer, and you'll see hundreds in Yabia Omer. He does sfek sfeikas with achronim. Maybe the halacha is like Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector, and if it's not, maybe it's like Rav Moshe Feinstein in the second case. A Lithuanian postek won't do things like that. John the Kaplan, the approach seems to work fine today. Well, it all depends how you view Pesach. If you view Pesach as taking a case and trying to see where it fits into the tradition of the Acharonim, trying to find out what the major trend of the Acharonim are, and if there's a disagreement, see if you can develop a suffix, a doubt, so then you go lenient, that's fine. But if your idea of Pesach is to try to create a building, a structure, start with the Gemara and come up with your individual idea of what the halacha should be based upon a new understanding of the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, then obviously you're not going to be satisfied with Rav Avadia. And from Rav Avadia's perspective, the Lithuanian approach is really not valid because that's not how Pesach is supposed to be done. And from the Lithuanian approach, the whole point of writing a tshuva is to have something to say. If you're simply going to record the various opinions and do minor chilukim, differences between them, you're going to come up with a very different approach. So I'm not saying one is worse than the other. They're just very different. And obviously if you've gone to the Lithuanian yeshivas, you're not going to be very attracted to Rav Avadia's method because you're not going to have the intellectual brilliance there. On the other hand, if you've grown up with believing that you need to have a wide-ranging knowledge of Acharonim in the Lithuanian world, they'll come up with ideas, and as Rav Avadia will point out, they don't even know that these ideas have been dealt with by tens of other authorities, and they'll just deal with it. Rav Moshe will deal with an issue as if he's the first one to deal with it. And yet many other posts have dealt with the same issue, and there's a tradition in many communities about how to do things. It's just a different approach. And Rav Schechter, it's interesting, as a student of the Rav, he very much follows, not completely, but because who has Bakiyas like Rav Avadia, but he's really very much a Bucky. He's quoting the Shoal and Meshiv and these others. He has Chidushim, but he's very much a believer in seeing what the Acharonim said about an issue and working yourself into the pattern of the Acharonim, which is not classical Lithuanian Pesach. Rav Yitzchak Yosef. For those who don't know, Rav Yitzchak Yosef is the son of Rav Avadia, maybe the greatest of his sons. He's published like the 25 volumes of Yalkut Yosef, which is, first of all, it's a new code of Jewish law. Many people use that as their code of Jewish law. If you want to know what the halacha is, you go to the Yalkut Yosef, and it tells you what to do in every circumstance, and Rav Avadia has been able to influence things that way. And if you look in the notes, you can have shiurim on every topic under the sun. Rav Yitzhak Yosef is also an incredible Bucky, just like his father. And on every issue, he'll quote everything. And, of course, their methods of psak are as you go there, as Dov points out. You can listen to him, and he'll explain how you need the achronim and how you have to work with saksek, and there's rules, there's various kalim. They work with kalim. That is, if this achron says that, and the other achron says it, and if you have four achronim, and if the Shulchan Aruch says it, and the Ramah disagrees, but the Shulchan Aruch doesn't say it, and the Ramah says it, who do you go with? Ashkenazim don't have these kalim. They work from... almost tabula rasa, try to develop the sock. And finally, let me just say that, I see it's already coming to the end, that I've really just touched the surface of Rav Avadia. In truth, I think that we have here more, not just a man, but a phenomenon. Someone who has permanently altered the halachic tradition of the Sephardic world, which is very significant. In terms of the Ashkenazic world, it's been a much harder breakthrough, of course. But his psukim have also influenced Ashkenazim a great deal. Again, go to the Bar Ilan computer and plug in Rav Avadia, and you'll see how his psukim have influenced him. But there's no paradigm changes with the Ashkenazim. We're still in a different world. However, in the Sephardic world, Sephardim today, even when they disagree with Rav Avadia, regard him as the Posek Hador, the Gadol Hador, and so much of their practices, the fact that the Yalkut Yosef has become the code of Jewish law for the Sephardic world, and the Rav Avadia Sidurim have become the Sidurim for the Sephardic world, show, I think, that he has created a change here, which, with all due respect to Rabbi Gisser, is not something that only exists during his lifetime. I can't imagine how, with the changes that have happened, the creation of an orthodox Sephardic world, Sephardim never had this sort of orthodoxy, that somehow this is going to change, especially since Rav Avadia has great Talmid HaChamim, the sons, the Rav of Harnof, Rav David, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, they are going to continue this approach. But, as I said, it remains to be seen. At least we can say that in his lifetime, he has done something almost imaginable. Uproot long-standing practices, bring the Sephardic Jewry back to their pride, and put them in the forefront of the Torah world in the state of Israel. In terms of questions, no, when they say all you need is the Shulchan Aruch, obviously there's lots of things that aren't in the Shulchan Aruch. You have all sorts of questions that aren't in the Shulchan Aruch. So you need Shuvot, and you need the Achronim from after the Shulchan Aruch. So what the Yalkut Yosef does is it goes through all the halachot. When the Shulchan Aruch says it, there's no problem. But what 90% of the things we are confronted with in the day-to-day are not found in the Shulchan Aruch. There's all sorts of other issues or things that the Shulchan Aruch is unclear about. So you need the Yalkut Yosef to explain all these other issues. Look in the Shulchan Aruch, for example, how to put on tefillin. You have a couple paragraphs there. Now we have long sparring with all the possibilities, all the very... That was one of Chaim Soloveitchik's major points, that now we're in the literary era. Things that in the Shulchan Aruch take up just a few lines, now we have whole sparim on them. So the Yalkut Yosef tries to bring together all these things, and so it's no contradiction. Much of what we do is not mentioned. That's why the Mishnah Berurah also. If everything was in the Ramah, we wouldn't need it, or in the Nosei Kelim. But there's many things, many issues that... and what about all the conflicts? Let's say there's a doubt. What does the Shulchan Aruch mean here? And you have the later posts, so you have to deal with it.
I gather from what you said that his halachic influence in America among Sephardim is very great as well.
Sure, yeah. Very great. He's regarded as the postsake. And it fits in very well, because for the most part, he's very lenient. When I was working, I remember I was working in a camp in Deal. He came. He wasn't chief rabbi even then. You should see the kavod malachim they gave him. He's their postsake. I can't imagine that the Moroccans perhaps saw Rav Messas, but Rav Avadia is the postsake. He's the leading authority for the Sephardim. They're little pockets, as I said. I don't know about America, certainly in Israel. I know there's a rabbi in California who doesn't like Rav Avadia. He's still a big believer of Mordechai Eliyahu because he says that Rav Avadia has uprooted all their minhagim. But no, he is the... All you have to do is, even if they don't know what he is, because look at the Sidurim they use, and look at the Yalkut Yosef. In my shul, we have a Persian community for the most part, but it's Rav Avadia's psukim. It's his Yalkut Yosef. Yes, his vision is very bad. That's why he wears those sunglasses. So it's a complicated figure, no question about it, a very significant figure. and one who I don't think we get a sense in the Ashkenazic world of really how important he is. Certainly the Chutzlars, we don't get an important. But in Israel, he's in the news almost every day, and certainly for the Sephardim, he's the leader of the most important, third most important party, or fourth most important party now in the Knesset. He's the power broker, so he obviously is a very significant figure. His influence on the Ashkenazic world has been minimal. No question. I don't think he has any real influence in Chutz Laaretz on the Ashkenazic world. In Israel, he does have an influence, because before he became identified with the Shas party, many of the religious Zionists that looked towards him as one of their gedolim, he used to sing HaTikvah and the rest of it. So until the early 1990s, or I should say the late 1980s, he was regarded as a post-sake by the Ashkenazic world. I can give many examples where Hezder Rosh Yeshiva and others, when they had a Shiva, they went to Rav Avadia. So in that sense, he was a great influence. I still remember when I was in Yeshiva in 84 to 85, and we were all Ashkenazing, Sakim of Rav Avadia Yosef were given to us as what to do, and this when we were all Ashkenazing. However, beginning in the late 1980s, first of all, he started showing much more stridently his ties to the left politically, so that alienated him from many of the Ashkenazic religious Zionists. And also, he began to assume Haredi tendencies. And so they stopped asking him questions. But when he was chief rabbi, and even a few years after that, when he was identified with the establishment, he was enormously influential, especially if you know the history. Rav Shlomo Goren basically alienated himself from much of the religious Zionist world because of, if we have a class on him, we'll talk about it. He was, by the time he finished his chief rabbi, he was left with a tiny group of people who supported him. The mainstream religious Zionists, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, went to Rav Avadia. The typical Ashkenazi religious Zionist, when he had a Shiloh, it was Rav Avadia. Rav Shlomo Goren had pretty much destroyed himself. But I don't think it's been lasting, his influence on the Ashkenazic world. The Sephardic world, I think it's been very lasting. Despite Rav Mordechai Eliyahu's attempt to challenge him. And you see what happened. After Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, the two succeeding Sephardic chief rabbis have been followers of Rav Avadia Yosef. And the Dayanim on the Batei Din are followers of Rav Avadia Yosef. So that's had an influence, obviously, but it hasn't been direct. So we can't really speak of it. Just like the Chazon Ish. Has the Chazon Ish influenced the Sephardic world? Absolutely not. They have no interest in him, and Rav Yashiv has no influence on the Sephardic world as well. The worlds are very split. The difference is that the religious Zionist world, to this day, it remains true. We don't have this ethnic break. In the Haredi world, Ashkenazim won't marry Sephardim, if they can help it, and Sephardim won't marry Ashkenazim. They want to have separate schools. They're very much separate from each other. In the Merkaz Harav world, in the Hezder world, you do not have this break. You do not have this ethnic tension. Ashkenazim, Sephardim, they really don't exist anymore. They each intermarry with each other, and that community, therefore, had no problem going to Rav Avadia. Since Rav Avadia is now more in the Haredi world, the Sephardim still relate to him for ethnic reasons, but there's no reason for Ashkenazim to look towards him anymore. That's how I would see it. Now, Rav Avadia speaks no English. He speaks Arabic. He's been sent on missions to the Egyptian government and elsewhere. He has no secular education. He's completely ignorant of things that we regard as basic. On the other hand, he's clearly intelligent, but he's not educated in the sense we think of. He's visited America numerous times. My only two times I've ever had any dealings with Rav Avadia are once when he came to the camp. He used to come like every year to America when he was chief rabbi, and until he became sick, he would still come. He came to the camp deal, and he spoke to the campers. One of the things was, in the Syrians, they don't wear kippot. So I remember he told them that at least when they eat and they make brachas, they should put a kippah on. And when I wrote my book on Shaul Lieberman and the Orthodox, there was this person from the seminary who kept saying that Rav Avadia would secretly come to the seminary and meet with Shaul Lieberman, and I knew it wasn't true. Rav Nissim would meet with him, but not Rav Avadia. So it took me about a week, but I was able to track down Rav Avadia's secretary, and I faxed the letter, and he brought it into Rav Avadia, and of course Rav Avadia replied that this is complete nonsense. He's never met with Shaul Lieberman. He didn't even know who Shaul Lieberman was. He said he heard of him, but he doesn't know him. And he would go to Europe every year also when he was chief rabbi. know, in America, America is very different. In America, the Haredim, if the Sephardim have been Ashkenazified, then they'll marry them. But I will tell you that Rabbi Hirsch, if he's still on the, he's not on the line anymore, he can attest to this. When we were living in Manhattan, the Rosh Kollel of the Upper West Side, he told one of the people we know, a Sephardi, he wouldn't set him up with this girl. He said she's an Ashkenazi. And then my Jonathan spoke to him, said, why would you tell me? He wouldn't set up because she's an Ashkenazi. And he tried to explain why, you know, we have to keep separate from the Sephardim. And so it's not totally absent here. But certainly in Israel, this isn't something, there's a much greater break between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazi ethnic tension. There is no real accepted post-stake for the modern Orthodox Rosh Zionist in Israel. That is true. I guess that would be the case. They go to Rabbi Henkin, who also Henkin. They go to, I guess they'll ask Rabbi Lichtenstein questions. They used to go to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Today there isn't. So you're right. But there's no great, I would say there's no great accepted post-stake for the Briskers in Israel either. They don't hold it for Rav Yashev. What can I say? No, he wore the colorful coat from the time he became chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Chief rabbis in Israel, even of cities, wear the colorful coat. And after when he no longer was chief rabbi, this was a big controversy. He refused to give up the title. He still holds the Rishon LeZion, but he still wants to keep chief rabbi. But he still wears the coat even though he's not chief rabbi, and that's become the practice now for all of them. It's not a halachic grounds, but we've explained today the problems of the Sephardim, some of them, that in learning. So the Ashkenazic world doesn't want to associate with them unless they become totally Ashkenazi. And then there's the other issues. A lot of the Sephardim today, they grew up, even if they look Haredi, they grew up in houses with television, they have relatives who aren't that religious, their parents don't, they have no yichus. The sorts of things that are important in the Haredi world, the Sephardi world don't have. If you can get a good yichus in Israel, I mean, if you have a good yichus, if you can get a good shidduch in Israel, it'll never be with a Sephardi. If you're a Ashkenazi Haredi and you can't get a good shidduch, you're not a good learner, so maybe you'll be stuck with a Sephardi. But that's not the sort of people they want to marry into. They want to marry into people who are Haredi already for a few generations, not people whose parents, first of all, follow Rav Avadia, or people who, what was Sephardic society one generation ago? These were not the Haredim. So just because the children ended up going to Haredi schools, this isn't something that a typical Ashkenazi Haredi wants to marry into. That's and that's the situation. But if they become the majority, that will change the ethos. I mean, that's what they said in America in the South, too. If the blacks become the majority, what's going to happen? But, you can't do that, I guess, in a democratic society. Yeah, but from their perspective, the Sephardim need to be converted to a form of Ashkenazi Haredim. And if you have them as the majority, the very notion that they have TVs in their house, some of their grandparents, how can you marry into a family where you go to your in-laws and there's a television in the house? So that's their perspective. Okay, well, if that's it, we will say thank you. This has been, I think, very enjoyable.
Can you hear me now?
No, I can't really hear you, Rabbi Kelman. I will say that it's been very enjoyable for those who are interested in the previous classes. They should all be up soon. Certainly the last two semesters are. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed all the comments after class and the emails. God willing, we'll pick up, I believe, after the Chagim, and there's many other important figures. We have even contemporary figures. There's still Rav Uziel. There's Rav Kafich. There's C. Pesach Frank, there's a Chaim Hirschenson, there's many, many Gedolim who had lots of interesting things to say. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Good night.